It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement. Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
Due to the graphic nature of this woman's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of murder, violence towards children, and child abuse that some people may find disturbing. We advise extreme caution for children under the age of 13.
At 8:30 a.m. on Monday, January 29th, 1979, the students of Grover Cleveland Elementary School in San Diego, California, started lining up outside the building as usual.
Their principal, Burton Ragg, was due any minute to unlock the gate to let them in, signaling the start of another school day.
Then, what sounded like firecrackers started popping off around them. Several children fell to the ground.
The other students looked around in confusion, not understanding what was happening. Then they began to panic, scattering and running.
Across the street, 16-year-old Brenda Spencer was aiming a rifle out the front window of her house toward the schoolyard and repeatedly pulling the trigger.
Before the shooting stopped that day, 8 children and a police officer suffered injuries. Principal Ragg and a custodian, Michael Sukar, were killed.
When a reporter asked Brenda why she was shooting innocent people, her reply would become so iconic, it inspired a rock song.
She said, "I don't like Mondays. This livens up the day."
Picture a murderer, a gangster, a thief. Did you picture a woman? We didn't think so. Society associates men with dangerous crimes.
But what happens when the perpetrator is female? Every Wednesday, we examine the psychology, motivations, and atrocities of female criminals.
Hi, I'm Sammy Nye.
And I'm Vanessa Richardson.
And you're listening to Female Criminals on the Parcast Network. This week begins our two-part presentation on Brenda Spencer, whose 1979 shooting spree, one Monday in January, is considered the first mass school shooting to happen in modern United States history.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram, at Parcast, and Twitter, at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information.
In today's episode, we'll cover Brenda Spencer's childhood. We'll talk about her family life, her few friendships, her interest in guns, and her increasing disenchantment with authority figures.
We'll also discuss the events leading up to the morning of the shooting and the first moments of January 29th, 1979.
In part two, we'll further explore the day of the shooting, Brenda's possible motivations, and the aftermath of that fateful Monday.
Brenda Ann Spencer was born on April 3rd, 1962, the third child of Wally and Dot Spencer. Shortly after her birth, the family of five relocated to a fairly upscale suburb of San Diego called San Carlos.
Wally went to work as an audiovisual technician at San Diego State University, while Dot took classes to become an accountant.
Brenda's parents appeared to have opposing personalities. Wally was considered a shy, soft-spoken man who was professional and steady at work, but not much interested in developing friendships outside the home.
In contrast, Dot was an extrovert. She ran her accounting business out of their house, building a client list that included a local church, the Del Mar Fairgrounds, and the University of San Diego bookstore.
An avid golfer, Dot also worked for 6 months of each year as a bookkeeper for the Andy Williams San Diego Open Golf Tournament at Torrey Pines. She was also an active volunteer for the Golf Association.
She even got the kids into golf. Brenda and her older siblings, Scott and Teresa, were all highly ranked in the San Diego Junior Golf Association. In 1971, at age 9, Brenda competed in one of the top divisions in the annual National Junior Tournament.
Brenda seemed to be a very active, athletic kid, also participating in softball, soccer, and bowling. Neighbors recalled Brenda fearlessly sliding down hillsides on sleds made of cardboard or doing wheelies on her bike.
She also loved animals and had many pets, including cats, dogs, rabbits, turtles, and even a snake. She often talked of wanting to become a veterinarian.
But by 1972, when Brenda was 10, things were unraveling in Wally and Dot's marriage. Wally had developed a drinking problem, though only Dot knew about it.
He was also unfaithful to her. According to Dot, quote, "He was fooling around with other women, and he came home one night and asked me if he could leave for a year if I'd let him come back. He'd already rented an apartment somewhere, and I just laughed. And a few days later, I filed for divorce," end quote.
During a bitter custody battle, Scott and Teresa, now teenagers, said they would prefer to live with their father. Because the judge didn't want to split up the children and was unaware of Wally's alcoholism, 10-year-old Brenda was also sent to live with him.
Dot stayed in the original home, while Wally bought a house on Lake Atlin Avenue a dozen blocks away. The house was right across the street from Grover Cleveland Elementary School, which Brenda attended until 1974.
For the first couple of years after the divorce, Brenda was eager to visit her mother, arriving before Dot came home from work and crawling over the back fence to play with the dogs Dot had. Brenda's grandmother, Ruth Hobel, said Brenda would cry when she had to leave Dot's house after court-ordered visitations were over.
But eventually, Brenda visited her mother less frequently. In fact, during this time, neighbors and family described Brenda as becoming a loner.
Vanessa's going to take over on the psychology here as well as throughout the episode. Please note that Vanessa is not a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist, but she has done a lot of research for this show.
Thanks, Sammy. According to an article by the American College of Pediatricians about the effects of divorce on children, a child of divorce may have weakened relationships with both parents who are adjusting to their own losses, as the custodial parent is less able to provide emotional support and the absent parent spends less time with the child.
Brenda's attorney, Michael McGlynn, described Brenda's mother after the divorce as becoming, quote, "like a stone, who never went out of her way to be with the kids or have a relationship with Brenda," end quote.
Children of divorced parents may also have more emotional distress and behavioral problems. According to a study published in the Journal of Family Psychology, children with divorced parents score significantly lower in psychological adjustment, social relations, and self-concept.
Self-concept is our perception of our behavior, abilities, and characteristics. It's closely tied to self-esteem.
The same study found that divorce can impact a child's academic development. When Brenda was younger, she earned good grades in school, but after her parents divorced, she began to dislike school and her grades slipped.
In addition to feeling neglected by her mother, Brenda began to suffer abuse at the hands of her father. Brenda said in later interviews that Wally would come home from work angry, yelling and calling her names, as well as hitting her in the face or the ribs.
She also accused her father of molesting her. Wally and Brenda shared a bedroom in the house on Lake Atlin Avenue, and according to Brenda, a bed. As there wasn't much furniture in the house, it was actually a mattress on the floor.
Brenda said that Wally touched her inappropriately and performed sodomy on her almost every night. There aren't any reports that Brenda informed anyone about the abuse, but her mother had her suspicions.
Dot said she could tell, quote, "by the way Brenda would be acting, very evasive if you asked her anything, it just wasn't her, so I knew something was wrong, but she would never really tell me," end quote.
When her mother was asked by an interviewer if, because of her suspicions, she ever tried to fight for custody of Brenda, Dot replied that she couldn't afford to hire an attorney.
Dr. Christine Courtois, in her 1988 book, Healing the Incest Wound, described victims of incest and child sexual abuse as often suffering many long-term effects. These include compulsive behaviors, depression, suicidal feelings, and abandonment issues.
During the same time period that Brenda claims she was being abused, some described Brenda as being her father's favorite child, seemingly in contrast to her statements. To outsiders, Brenda and her father appeared to have a close relationship. She would often stroke his hair.
In her book, Keepers of the Children, Laura Ramirez says that victims of sexual abuse can feel guilt and shame because the act itself, the attention, the contact, the fondling by an attentive parent, may create sensations that make the child feel good. Because of this, the child often ends up with a sense of self-loathing and feelings of unworthiness. If the abuse occurred as Brenda described, it might have contributed to her later actions.
In 1976, when Brenda was 14, she suffered a serious bicycle accident, running into a telephone pole and striking her head. According to her brother Scott, after hitting the pole, Brenda blacked out and was woozy the next day, unable to remember what happened.
Dot described Brenda as seeming to be drunk and sleepy the next day. She told Brenda to have her father take her to the hospital. Wally didn't want to do it, but Brenda's sister, Teresa, said she would take her instead. However, it's not known if Teresa actually took Brenda to the doctor or not.
Brenda's family said she seemed fine 2 or 3 days later, and they didn't notice any change in her behavior after the accident. However, a few years after the accident, Brenda was diagnosed with frontal lobe epilepsy.
According to the Mayo Clinic, frontal lobe epilepsy is a fairly common form of epilepsy where seizures originate in the front of the brain.
Doctors theorized that Brenda's bicycle accident caused an undiagnosed brain injury, which then led to frontal lobe epilepsy.
Seizures from frontal lobe epilepsy often involve repetitive motions, such as bicycle pedaling or rocking, head and eye movement to one side, or abnormal body posturing, like one arm extending out while the other flexes.
But as the seizures often occur during sleep, it's possible no one noticed Brenda was exhibiting symptoms of the condition.
Although her family said they didn't notice any changes in Brenda after her bicycle accident, it was around this time that Brenda started exhibiting less than ideal behavior, including her first run-ins with the law.
Up next, we'll look deeper into what was happening in Brenda's life as she started to act out in very troubling ways.
Now, back to the story.
In 1976, 14-year-old Brenda Spencer suffered a head injury in a bicycle accident. Though her family reported that she appeared fine after a few days, it's likely that the incident caused brain damage and led to frontal lobe epilepsy.
According to brain injury advisor Janet M. Cromer, brain injuries can sometimes cause profound changes in personality. Damage to specific areas of the brain, including the frontal lobe, can impair executive functions. That's the complex group of skills we use to plan, make decisions, problem solve, make sound judgments, and get along with others.
People with frontal lobe injuries may appear to develop aggression. However, in other cases, their behavior may be misunderstood as depression as they display antisocial tendencies.
Brenda preferred to engage in activities that didn't require a lot of social contact, such as photography or taking care of her pets. Many of her teachers remarked that Brenda was quiet and introverted. She didn't have many friends at school.
Instead, she spent a great deal of time with her father, Wally. He was often as socially isolated as Brenda was. One of their common pastimes was target shooting. Wally owned several guns, and he taught Brenda to shoot at an early age. By all accounts, she really enjoyed it.
On weekends, the two would often visit Wally's friends, Tom and Jan Miner, to shoot guns on their property. The couple lived south of San Diego near the Mexican border in a tiny community called Potrero.
It was desert country, in the most extreme southwestern portion of San Diego County, accessible only by dirt roads.
Brenda, her father, and Tom Miner would venture deep into the desert and target shoot at cans and pieces of wood. Brenda got to be a very good shot.
Susie Stewart, one of the few friends Brenda had, would occasionally accompany them to Potrero. Susie said Brenda taught her how to handle a gun, and they would practice at her house. She called Brenda an excellent shot.
She said that they also engaged in more typical activities like watching TV, listening to music, and swimming at the beach.
But they eventually grew apart. Susie developed more of an interest in dating and guys, and Brenda hadn't. Susie said, quote, "Between the two of us, I was the leader. She's the follower type," end quote.
Possibly as a way to fit in, Brenda would brag in front of her classmates. One student at Brenda's school, Stuart Heising, said Brenda was always talking about guns, bragging about the guns her father had.
Teresa said her sister would also, quote, "brag about taking heavy drugs, but when she described their effects and what they looked like, I knew she was not telling the truth," end quote.
Susie Stewart agreed that Brenda didn't do drugs except for sometimes smoking pot, and even drinking a beer made her throw up. This was confirmed by Brenda's father, who said she occasionally had one beer, but no more than that.
Brenda's brother, Scott, described her as, quote, "a happy person, though somewhat of a loner because she had so many interests. She spent much of her time taking care of her animals. She loved to read and write poetry," end quote.
But Teresa reported that Brenda often wished she had more friends.
When Brenda was 14, she started spending more time with the boy who lived next door, Brent Fleming. He was 3 years younger than Brenda and had a troubled family life, including a rocky relationship with his mother and stepfather. Teresa described him as a mixed-up kid.
By all accounts, their relationship was strictly platonic, but according to almost everyone who was interviewed, Brent was considered destructive, a troublemaker, and was thought to be a bad influence on Brenda.
Tom Miner said that Wally was at first kind to Brent and tried to help him out. Brent came to visit the Miners in Potrero with Wally and Brenda 4 or 5 times, but Brent was a hard kid to help, always tearing things up. Jan Miner described Brent as, quote, "a very forceful person for his age. To be honest, I did not care for him very much," end quote.
Similar to Susie Stewart's estimation, Jan described Brenda as the follower in the relationship. Psychologist Carl Pickhart describes this dynamic in his article, Adolescence and the Dominating Friend, by saying, "If you don't want to be directed by parents, but don't feel ready to independently direct yourself, there is an adolescent middle way. Establish a transitional dependence on a dominating peer who will take the lead while you follow along."
Dr. Pickhart says the window for a domination relationship tends to be from early to mid-adolescence, ages 9 through 15. And Brenda, who was still struggling with self-esteem and a sense of self, found that dominating peer in Brent. Brenda's brother, Scott, didn't mince words when it came to Brent Fleming. He said, quote, "If there is a Satan, Brent's form has been taken over. Just being in the same room with him is weird. I know it sounds ridiculous, but he has a certain magnetism. I know he got Brenda in trouble," end quote.
The first indicator of this trouble came in 1978 when Brenda was 16. She and Brent were caught shoplifting. Brenda insisted she was only standing outside a store, and it was actually Brent who was caught attempting to shoplift.
But when authorities were called and they took Brent out of the store, as they passed Brenda, Brent pointed to her and said, "She's with me."
On the other hand, classmates said that Brenda bragged about this shoplifting incident and others, seemingly proud of her run-in with police.
So it's not clear whether Brenda was actually guilty or not.
Brenda soon had a second run-in with police, also in 1978. Cleveland Elementary School, located across the street from her house, was broken into and vandalized. Brent Fleming claimed he and Brenda were responsible.
But Brenda denied her involvement. She said Brent approached her and asked her to come with him to see what he found. The window to the elementary school had already been broken, presumably by Brent, and the door was open. She admitted that she followed him inside.
It's possible she helped Brent in the vandalism, but the details of what was destroyed are not clear. It was rumored that several windows were shot out with a gun and that Brenda was the culprit, but this was later disproved.
Carol Freeze, a teenage neighbor of Brenda's, identified Brenda and Brent to the police as the vandals who broke into the school, and they were arrested.
Afterward, the two held a grudge against Carol for ratting them out.
Brenda was ordered to see a counselor through the county's youth services. Noreen Harmon, who also served as a parole officer, began to counsel Brenda in the summer of 1978.
Brent and Brenda would often hang out at her house and listen to records by rock groups like The Beatles, Kiss, and Foghat. Brenda also loved Alice Cooper and constantly listened to his album, Killer, which featured the song Dead Babies.
According to Brenda's sister, Teresa, their father told Brenda not to hang out with Brent anymore after the two incidents with the law, but she ignored him, continuing to see Brent when Wally was away from the house.
Wally said that he didn't like Brent's attitude. He would often comment that, quote, pigs should die, end quote.
Pig was a common 1970s slang term for the police. Brent's stepfather was a San Diego police officer, and Brent's reported hatred for his stepfather, as well as run-ins with the law, likely influenced his views about police in general. Soon, Brenda shared those anti-authoritarian views, also referring to the police as pigs.
Wally said of their relationship, quote, Brenda, of course, was affected by him. There were times when she indicated she disliked police officers, but Brenda was a lot of talk. I had no reason to associate such with any actual conduct, end quote.
Others also remembered Brenda spouting dislike for the police. Susie Stewart said when she and Brenda watched television together, they both would root against the cops.
According to Brent, he and Brenda concocted elaborate plans detailing how they would kill a random police officer.
In one, they would approach a police officer in his patrol car at a public park and shoot the officer there, or perhaps handcuff him and drag him to the restrooms and then kill him.
An alternate plan involved egging the officer's car or breaking his window to get the officer to chase after them. They would lure him into the park restrooms, and then Brenda would kill him with an axe.
Brent said, quote, Brenda and I were always kind of planning things, but we never really carried them out, end quote.
It was a great relief to Wally when Brent and his family moved north of San Diego to Santee, California, in August 1978. Though they still talked occasionally on the phone, Wally felt like Brenda was less under Brent's influence with this distance.
According to her father, after Brent Fleming moved away, Brenda's general attitude improved. In the fall of 1978, she started her junior year at Patrick Henry High School. Her grades started to improve, and she was particularly engaged in her photography class.
Photography was another hobby that Brenda and Wally shared, in addition to target shooting. He often took Brenda to the zoo or up into the mountains to take pictures.
That fall, Brenda entered a photo contest put on by the Humane Society and won the grand prize, as well as two other prizes.
Outwardly, she seemed to be doing well, but inwardly, Brenda was spiraling into depression.
Brenda's mother, Dot, said of her mental state at the time, quote, "When around me, Brenda was not depressed. She seemed very content with life. I did not get the impression that she masked her feelings, but she evidently did," end quote.
On December 20th, 1978, Brenda went to see her state-appointed counselor, Noreen Harmon. The details of what Brenda confided in Noreen are unknown, but the counselor became so alarmed by Brenda's state of mind that she referred her to a psychiatrist.
Noreen feared Brenda might commit suicide. She described Brenda as unwilling to discuss any future plans or even acknowledge the future existed.
She also noted Brenda's lack of self-esteem and isolation from peers and parents.
Sadly, when Brenda met with the psychiatrist, all they recommended at this time was for her to keep seeing her counselor, Noreen.
Brenda's parents were, of course, informed about her fragile mental state, but Dot preferred, as usual, to let her ex-husband handle it. She never talked to Brenda about her problems or being suicidal.
And Wally, as usual, swept the issue under the rug. Neither parent seemed to realize their daughter was a time bomb, about to explode.
Coming up, we'll follow the events that led to Brenda's shooting spree.
Now, back to the story.
In December of 1978, 16-year-old Brenda Spencer was suffering from extreme depression. Her counselor, Noreen Harmon, was so concerned for Brenda that she sent her to speak with a psychiatrist. However, this appointment didn't seem to improve her mental state.
Her older siblings, Scott and Teresa, were unaware of her emotional distress. They said Brenda appeared her usual self during Christmas and cooked Christmas dinner when the family and relatives got together.
Incredibly, despite her suicidal warning signs, Wally gave Brenda a .22-caliber rifle for Christmas that year. He might have been unaware of her severe depression or even assumed that the gun would make her happier, as target shooting was a hobby she enjoyed so much.
Dot said she hit the roof when she learned Wally gave their daughter a rifle for Christmas, but her concerns were more about Brenda's young age rather than her mental state.
According to Teresa, Brenda had begged their father for months to buy her a rifle, so he obliged her. But according to Brenda, quote, "I had asked for a radio and he bought me a gun. I felt like he wanted me to kill myself," end quote.
In January 1979, Wally and Brenda visited Tom and Jan Miner in Potrero to go target shooting in the desert. Brenda brought along her new rifle.
According to Tom Miner, quote, "Brenda knew more about her .22-caliber rifle than I did. I think, had it come unassembled, she would have been able to assemble it. She set the scope herself. She was a better shot than I am, and I am a very good marksman," end quote.
There was no more mention of Brenda's troubles the month before, but Jan Miner commented that Brenda's behavior was erratic and extremely out of character. Brenda spoke at length about Alice Cooper and his song Dead Babies. She also talked a lot about Carol Freeze, the girl who'd told police she'd seen Brenda and Brent break the windows at Cleveland Elementary.
Even though the incident happened a year before, Jan said Brenda seemed agitated and angry about it all over again. It made her wonder if Brenda might have been under the influence of drugs.
According to her father, Wally, Brent Fleming called Brenda several times during the week before the shooting.
Possibly because he thought it would cheer up his depressed daughter, Wally gave permission for Brent to visit Brenda on Saturday, January 27th. Brent made the hour-long journey by bike to visit Brenda in San Diego.
They listened to records a lot of the day, especially Alice Cooper's album, Billion Dollar Babies. Wally said he left the house between noon and 1 p.m., and when he got back, Brenda and Brent were gone and didn't return until about 2:30 p.m.
About that same time on Saturday, Brenda and Brent appeared on their bikes on the street across from Carol Freeze's house. They still held a grudge after she reported them to the police for breaking into Cleveland Elementary.
According to the Freeze family, Brenda and Brent didn't say anything, but they stared at the Freezes for a long time while the family washed their car, mowed their lawn, and did gardening activities. The Freezes believed the two were playing mind games, so they ignored Brenda and Brent.
Carol Freeze said later that Brenda avoided her in school and never said anything derogatory to her. The family also denied that any overt threats were made to them or to Carol in particular. Still, Brenda's and Brent's actions on that Saturday could certainly be construed as trying to intimidate the family.
Brent revealed later that when he visited on Saturday, January 27th, Brenda, seemingly wanting to impress him, told him she was going to do something really big on Monday.
He said, quote, "We were always saying those kinds of things, but we never did it. I thought she might shoot some windows out with the .22 her father bought her," end quote.
Wally said that Brent left to go back home on Saturday around 3 or 3:30 p.m., Brenda stayed in her room listening to records until dinner time. Wally said everything seemed normal the rest of the weekend and that Brenda wasn't acting in an unusual manner.
On Sunday evening, Brenda asked Wally for the keys to his van. Some of her clothes were inside. Wally said she came back in the house with her sweatshirt, some thermal pants, and another shirt wadded up in her hands. She gave her father back the keys and went to bed.
That was likely when Brenda retrieved boxes of ammunition that Wally kept in his van, a total of about 500 rounds of long-shelled .22-caliber bullets.
The next day, Monday, January 29th, 1979, Wally went to wake up Brenda for school and found her already dressed, but she complained of not feeling well, saying she had stomach cramps and nausea from menstruating.
This wasn't unusual. Most months, starting 2 days before and continuing through much of her period, Brenda suffered from cramps so painful she would spend hours in a hot bathtub just to endure them. She often stayed home from school at least one day because of the pain.
According to the Center for Young Women's Health, painful periods are a condition called dysmenorrhea. It's normal for women to feel mild discomfort and cramping during menstruation, but if the pain isn't relieved with over-the-counter medication or causes a person to miss school or other daily activities, it could mean there's a more serious reason for the symptoms.
Dot Spencer knew of her daughter's painful periods and was aware Brenda stayed home from school because of them, but neither she nor Wally indicated they had ever taken Brenda to see a doctor because of the issue.
Wally noted that Brenda looked sick and pale, and he said she could stay home from school. He left for work around 7 a.m.
We don't know exactly what occupied Brenda Spencer's time that morning between 7 a.m. and when she started shooting at 8:30 a.m. Brenda claimed she spent that time drinking and taking drugs.
But there was no evidence of drug use at the scene. A quarter full pint bottle of Southern Comfort whiskey was found in the front of the house, but Brenda's tox screen after her arrest was negative. She didn't have any alcohol or drugs in her system. Brenda's father had been on the wagon for a few years, so the whiskey didn't belong to him. No one could ever explain where the liquor came from.
This would be only one of many questions regarding the case. Another question was why Brenda chose this day to do something really big, as she had told Brent Fleming.
According to Dr. Alan Lipman, a clinical psychologist and director of the Center for the Study of Violence, people who commit mass killings don't always just snap. He says, quote, "First of all, there's a period of buildup, then there's anger and hopelessness, and then finally, there is the trigger. Something that causes them to go from just an angry person to being a killer," end quote.
But what triggered Brenda Spencer to pick this particular day is unclear. Except for her visit with Brent, she was alone with her father the entire weekend before the shooting, and Wally claimed things appeared normal.
Even though Brenda might not come across as having all the characteristics of a typical mass shooter, she did share something with them. She was depressed and feeling hopeless, and she didn't feel anyone was listening.
The biggest question, of course, is why? Why would Brenda Spencer, a 16-year-old girl, target elementary school children and the adults caring for them as the objects of mass murder?
As the clock crept closer to 8:30 a.m., and Cleveland Elementary school children started lining up outside the gate, waiting for another Monday to begin, Brenda Spencer, rifle in hand, was ready to address that question in her own tragic way. Thanks again for tuning in to Female Criminals. In next week's episode, we'll discuss the timeline of the shooting spree and further explore what might have caused Brenda Spencer to commit such a violent act. We'll also follow up on what happened to Brenda and others involved in the events of that fateful day.
You can find more episodes of Female Criminals, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, or your favorite podcast directory.
Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time. Female Criminals was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, with sound design by Russell Nash. Production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Liebeskind. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Freddie Beckley. Female Criminals is written by Kristen Kirby and stars Sammy Nye and Vanessa Richardson.